This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Hello and welcome. Welcome to VOA Africa. Thank you for joining us. I'm Yehia Suhib in Washington. Here's what's coming up on Africa News Tonight.
We lack so many basic amenities like toilet facility, health facilities, with other social amenities, because we don't have even potable water.
That's Adamu Salikaya, who has been helping victims of cholera in Nigeria's displacement camp. Details coming up. Also, a new coronavirus variant with multiple mutations has been detected in South Africa. These stories and more on Africa News Tonight. We start with our top story. Nigerian health officials say nearly 1,800 people have died from cholera this year, with cases found in more than 20 states across the country. To combat the bacterial disease spread by dirty water, Nigeria's Federal Ministry of Environment is urging proper hygiene and organizing mass cleanups in affected areas. Timothy Obiezu reports from the site of an outbreak in the capital, Abuja.
At New Kuchigoro Camp for internally displaced people in Abuja, camp officials say at least 40 cases of cholera have been recorded there since a recent surge began in July. Most of the patients were first treated in the camp by Adamu Salikaya, a self-educated pharmacist who usually refers severe cases to hospitals. But officials say at least 10 people have died so far, including Estefanos Beatrice's 7-year-old son, who died early August, despite receiving overnight first aid treatment for diarrhea at Salikaya's dispensary. Beatrice says the death of his son devastated him. Beatrice said his son had received 7 infusions that night and got better. At home the next morning, the boy was okay, but about 11 a.m. the severe diarrhea came back and the boy died soon after. Diarrhea is a common symptom of cholera, a bacterial disease that causes dehydration. It is often severe in children. The Nigerian Center for Disease Control, NCDC, says the country's death toll from cholera this year stands at about 1,800. At last count, there were about 48,000 cases spread across 24 of Nigeria's 36 states. NCDC says children between 5 and 14 years old were mostly affected. Michael Obunna, a health planning research and statistics officer at the Ministry of Health, says the government is taking action to reduce the spread and treat infected people.
We have cholera control systems programs that are already on ground matching efforts against the spread of cholera. I want to assure you that actions are going on through some of the quarters and branches of the ministry where these programs are being anchored.
The programs include sensitization on proper hygiene and cleanup exercises, especially in affected areas, to halt the outbreak and stop the disease's spread. Camp officials in New Kuchigoro have been encouraging the same at the camp, but Salikaya says good hygiene is not easy to achieve with closely built shelters and inadequate water supply.
We lack so many basic amenities like toilet facility, health facilities, with other social amenities, because we don't have even potable water. These are the kind of things that is contributing cholera outbreak.
Cholera is easily transmitted by eating or drinking contaminated food or water. Floods caused by the rainy season contribute to the spread. The rains will go away soon, but victims say unless congested camps like this are expanded, the cholera threat will always be there. Timothy Obiezu for VOA News, Abuja, Nigeria.
The son of Mozambique's ex-president Armando Guebuza has testified that he did not benefit from $2 billion in secret government loans. Ndambi Guebuza told the judge yesterday that he never received money from Privinest, the company in the heart of the scandal. Guebuza said he has no knowledge of emails presented in court as evidence of his involvement. The younger Guebuza is one of 19 high-profile defendants facing trial in the capital Maputo. The trial began last week. The French news agency AFP says Ndambi Guebuza is accused of receiving $33 million from Privinvest, an international shipbuilding group, to convince his father, who was president at the time, to approve corrupt maritime projects. The loan scandal surfaced in 2016, prompting donors such as the International Monetary Fund to cut off financial support to Mozambique, triggering a sovereign debt default and currency collapse. South African police say almost 5,800 people were murdered in the country in just 3 months from April to June this year. International crime monitoring organizations say South Africa has the 10th highest murder rate in the world. In Africa, only tiny Lesotho, which is locked within the borders of South Africa, has a higher incidence of murder. Darren Taylor has more from Johannesburg.
The police say most crimes, including home invasions, armed robberies, and carjacking, are on the rise in South Africa. The government says several factors are contributing to this, including high unemployment and a culture of violence it blames on apartheid. Police Minister Bheki Cele described the latest crime statistics as high and unnatural.
Conduct crimes such as murder, attempted murder, sexual offences, and all categories of assault registered 60.6% increase compared to the corresponding period of the previous financial year. In the 3 months of reporting, a 66.2% increase in murder was recorded. This is 2,294 more people killed compared to the corresponding period in the previous financial year.
But he says the massive spike isn't necessarily unexpected. Because of the COVID-19 pandemic, the government locked the country down for much of 2020. With the economy at a standstill, crime rates plummeted. Now that society is almost back to normal, says Tsele, so is South Africa's crime. Using the example of contact crimes registered between April and June in the normal year of 2019, compared with the same period this year, Tsele says there's been an increase of less than 10%. Some crime analysts point out that in most countries, an almost 10% increase in murders, rapes, and assaults would be a national crisis. Not in South Africa. The World Population Review's International Crime Index ranks it as having the third highest rate of violent crime in the world, behind only Venezuela and Papua New Guinea. Tsele acknowledges South Africans are a people under siege.
From a sample of 4,467 cases, it was determined that a total of 2,531 people were murdered in public places like on the street, open fields, parking areas, and abandoned buildings and beaches. 1,385 murders occurred at the home of the victim or the perpetrator.
Criminologist Jean Redpath says South Africans feel they've nowhere to hide.
The whole country is traumatized, and that trauma gets carried on. So often people who are committing crimes are themselves traumatized. That trauma gets built upon. So we are a nation in huge trauma. So maybe if it's a less...
Local aid groups say between 40 and 50,000 rapes are reported in the country every year, but the crime is vastly underreported. Global rape indexes say South Africa has the highest rate of rape in the world. The government's latest statistics support this, with just over 10,000 rapes reported between April and June. Redpath says South Africa's police service remains a largely directionless organization, with poor leadership and clouded by corruption.
Trust in the police has reached really extremely low levels that should really be of concern to government.
but she's most worried about the increase in murders in all 9 provinces.
I've done an analysis of the murder rate. Murder is what we can really trust. And I've looked at the previous year, 2019, and we see across the board huge increases in every province, 24% increase in Limpopo, 14% in KwaZulu-Natal. Those are figures of real concern.
Redpath says lack of adequate policing means citizens have to protect themselves. This in turn will cause a rise in cases of people in poorer communities taking the law into their own hands, and wealthier citizens continuing to rely on private security firms to keep safe. For VOA News, I'm Darren Taylor in Johannesburg.
The United Nations Environmental Programme held a ceremony Monday marking the end of toxic leaded gasoline use in vehicles worldwide. A company in Nairobi, where the UNEP is headquartered, is working on the next step, converting buses and utility vehicles to electric power. Lenny Ruvaga reports from Nairobi.
Lucy Mugala goes about checking on the energy levels of battery modules lined neatly on a workshop table. Mugala is an engineer at Opibus, a privately owned 4-year-old Nairobi company that converts cars and public transport vehicles to run on electricity. Today, Mugala and fellow engineer Esther Wairimu are fine-tuning plans to outfit a public transport bus with lithium batteries. Mugala says converting this bus reduces the effects of greenhouse emissions responsible for global warming.
A lot has been done currently in terms of mitigating the effect of greenhouse gases in Kenya, but very little is being done in the electrical vehicle sector. And that is a gap we're trying to fill as Opibus. We are looking at maximizing impact by targeting the largest sector, which is the public transport sector. And with this, we will be able to, step by step, be able to achieve a low carbon economy in Kenya and in Africa at large.
Douglas Aguata has been in the public transport industry for 15 years. On average, Aguata spends around $80 on fuel daily, a cost he'd like to see come down. However, Aguata says that drivers like him may find it challenging to adapt to electric vehicles.
Kujenji kuna gharama sababu kuna wenye mali kwingine hakuna station.
He says that converting the engines from gasoline to electric is quite costly, and that one may also find that there is a scarcity of charging stations, and this may prove to be quite challenging. Joshua Anampiu is the strategy and planning manager at the National Environment Trust Fund, or NET Fund, a state corporation that raises funds for sustainable environmental management in Kenya. Anampiu says shifting towards clean energy requires investment from the government, but he argues that the investment will be worth it.
No matter how costly it looks right now, we know in the long run it will be more effective towards preserving our environment, which is an existential threat right now if we don't take care of the environment. So yes, there are areas where we need to put up infrastructure. We need to change the entire mechanisms of the infrastructure. And this obviously is costly. And so going forward, maybe invest now, put in a bit more cash, and then we'll reap the benefits in the future.
The global end of leaded gasoline use has been lauded as a milestone by the United Nations Environment Programme. Jane Akumu is a program manager at UNEP. Akumu adds that a lot more needs to be done to ensure efficacy in abolishing the use of leaded gasoline.
You know, we need a lot of awareness for people to know why it's important to have cleaner fuels, cleaner vehicles. Policymakers need to also come in, and especially standards bodies. It's important for them to set regulations in place because the industry is pushed by regulation. What we've noticed is that in some of the countries where there's no regulation, poor fuel quality, poor vehicle qualities are imported.
For Mugala and other clean energy champions, the challenge will be to reduce the costs of going electric and encourage consumers to go green. Lenny Ruvaga for VOA News, Nairobi.
South African scientists are studying a new coronavirus variant with multiple mutations that has been detected in that country and several others. Scientists have yet to establish whether this variant is more contagious or whether it can overcome the immunity provided by vaccines or prior infections. Reuters News reports the new variant, known as C.1.2, was first detected in May and has spread to most South African provinces and to other countries in Africa, Europe, Asia, and Oceania. Richard Lessels, an infectious disease specialist and one of the authors of the research on C.1.2, says people should not be overly alarmed at this stage. He says variants with more mutations were bound to emerge further into the pandemic. Police in Zimbabwe this past week announced the arrests of suspects in a case that has highlighted the entrenched practice of child marriage by an apostolic religious sect. The custom violates laws against child marriage and sexual relations with minors. Arigando has more on the story.
Police recently announced the arrest of 26-year-old Atirarame Momberume on charges of rape after he impregnated 15-year-old Anna Machai at the shrine of the apostolic group called the Joan Marange sect. The young girl, who is said to have been forced out of school and forced into marriage, died due to complications arising from childbirth and was buried at the shrine. In a statement released to the public, police spokesman Paul Nyati also announced the arrest of the late girl's parents, Edmond Machaya and mother, Rachel Machaya, on charges of obstruction of justice. Charge arises out of what the police allege is the attempt by the parents to mislead them by initially reporting that the deceased was actually 22-year-old Memory Machaya, who it turns out is alive. Some news reports say parents also tried to pledge a 9-year-old daughter to Momberume after the death of his child bride. All three have since been denied bail. The husband of the deceased child is now facing a murder charge for the death of the minor through the pregnancy he caused. He is also charged with having sexual intercourse with a young person, a crime that can lead up to 10 years in prison. The Minister of Justice, Legal and Parliamentary Affairs, Ziyambi Ziyambe, recently told Parliament that the accused was not legally married to the late girl and that there was no marriage certificate. Under the current laws, only registered marriages are recognized. He said the deceased girl was only cohabiting with the accused. Compounding the problem for child protection activists is the fact that under the current Marriages Act of 1964, a girl is allowed to marry at age 16, whereas it is 18 years for boys. In addition, does not set a required age for customary marriages. Zimbabwe's parliament is considering legislation to update the act. Observers say that religion and custom are among the major reasons for child marriages. Skangele Ngwenya is a member of the Young Women's Alliance.
So religion is generally reversing the gains of gender equality. My problem is here with religion. There's an assumption that there is a supreme power or a supernatural power that commands a certain man or a certain leader of a church to then give down orders and rules to the congregation. So at the end of the day, when people are being brainwashed like that, they then fail to make their own personal decisions. This is why you see that women are then married to people that they don't even know, or people that they don't even love, especially in the apostolic sect.
Another girl child protection activist with the Youth for Development Trust, Tabiso Jamela, says the death of Anna Machaya and arrest of the so-called husband places a spotlight on religious practices by the cult which put the lives of women at risk.
I think we really need to find a means of how to penetrate the sect and some of the reasons why these people have been practicing such harmful practices is because of the belief that they are immune, or the belief that they are untouchable. We also need to look at this matter in terms of the public health angle, whereby we have one of the highest maternal mortality rates in the whole continent, and some of those actually are contributed to by the teenage pregnancies. But we also have this aspect whereby they do not allow their members to seek health care.
UNICEF says that globally, countries vary in the age of consent for marriage, ranging from 11 in Nigeria, 16 in the UK, and 20 in South Africa. Observers say that political will and community buy-in are required in an effort to protect the girl child. Reporting for VOA, this is Adigono in Bulawayo, Zimbabwe.
President Salva Kiir urged South Sudan's lawmakers to focus on implementing the country's revitalized peace deal as he inaugurated the reconstituted parliament. Journalist Wake Simon Wudu reported for VOA that the president said the unity government's objective for the remainder of the transitional period is to end the country's war by fully implementing the 2018 agreement. Monday's inauguration of the parliament of 650 lawmakers is behind the schedule. Under the peace agreement's timeline, it should have been opened in early 2019. The deal also says the legislature's term should run concurrently with that of the unity government until elections are held. The agreement says the transitional government should run for 36 months from the signing of the peace deal in 2018, which means it should end next March. Botswana, facing increased conflict between local communities and wildlife, has launched a 5-year wildlife management plan. Conflict between humans and wild animals has claimed over a dozen lives in recent months, with most of the deaths due to elephant attacks. From Habrone, Botswana, reporter Mokondisi Dube has the details.
Botswana developed the wildlife management plan early this year, and the document is now being taken to affected communities for debate. Gabelo Sinyatso is the director of Wildlife and National Parks.
We've lost 19 people, and the injuries reported to us number 22. I should highlight, though, that in terms of the injury, these just relate to injuries due to what we call dangerous animals, which are your typical big five. As well as hippos and crocodiles. And in terms of people killed, this is those that have lost their lives to all wildlife, regardless of species. Elephants account for the majority of both the injuries and deaths.
Sinyatso says the management plan seeks to reduce conflict between local communities and wildlife. This will include the protection of water sources, the construction of fences, and increasing awareness of the dangers of wild animals, elephants in particular.
That plan has 6 components, one of which talks to human wildlife conflict. It's typically because of increased elephant populations, some of it due to barriers, physical barriers that are preventing the elephants from moving to explore the entire range within Southern Africa, so that really is restricted to Botswana. But unfortunately, we've also had some mortality or injuries due to, human behavior, where people sometimes deliberately or unintentionally provoke animals, which then respond by attacking.
The management plan also includes controlled elephant hunting. The World Conservation Body, the International Union for Conservation of Nature, or IUCN, recently listed elephants as critically endangered. The declining numbers are due to, among others, loss of habitat and poaching. But while the numbers are decreasing elsewhere in the world, Botswana's elephant herd is growing. Ben Okita Oma, the IUCN's co-chairperson of the Elephant Specialist Group, says hunting can be used as part of a management plan in countries where populations are on the increase.
Hunting is one of those that is one of those sustainable use of that are admissible within the sustainable framework. And list animal as critically endangered has probably never stopped such sustainable use of those critically endangered species.
Botswana has the world's largest elephant population at more than 130,000. Economists say wildlife can bring in lucrative tourist dollars if they are managed properly and if a balance can be achieved between the animals and local communities. For VOA, this is Mkondisi Dube in Habrone, Botswana.
And that wraps up this edition of African News Tonight. I'm Gaius Wuhib in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voanews.com. On behalf of our producer, Mokbili Abaro, thank you again for tuning in and choosing the Voice of America.
VOA brings you the best in African music on the African beat. African Beat showcases the latest and the greatest of contemporary African music, from bobo music to hip life, bonga flavor to soukous, afrobeat to ndombolo and makossa to kwaito. The African Beat on VOA has it all. And it's happening right here, Mondays through Fridays at 09:05 and 20:05 UTC, right after the international.